Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Drew Koenig. We are talking about another short story compilation, kinda sorta. There is a novella in here and two poems. So there are 19 short stories, 22 things in total, and I am quickly going to run down the list of included works here before we jump in, because we will not be talking about every single one of them, just because a lot of them don't really require an in-depth discussion, in my opinion. So starting from the top, we have The Mist, Here There Be Tigers, The Monkey, Cain Rose Up, Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, The Jaunt, The Wedding Gig, Paranoid, A Chant, The Raft, Word Processor of the Gods, great title if you ask me, The Man Who Would Not Shake Hands, Beach World, The Reaper's Image, Nona, For Owen, Survivor Type, Uncle Otto's Truck, Morning Deliveries, Milkman Number 1, Big Wheels, A Tale of the Laundry Game, Milkman Number 2, Grandma, The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, and The Reach. That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
So, Drew, was this your first time going through Skeleton Crew? I know you picked up the audiobook for it, and I somehow read through it.
It was my first time with Skeleton Crew overall. I read The Mist about 5 years ago, so I feel like it was still pretty
okay
in my brain. But yeah, the rest of these were totally new to me.
The Mist is one that has been published on its own since the release of this book, because this book came out in June of 1985, and I was reading the first edition paperback of it, so a pretty old copy. And because of the movie adaptation later on for The Mist, and then again when it was adapted into a TV show, that is a story that has sort of just popped up in its own novella form. And that's something we've seen with multiple Stephen King novellas because of adaptations. You know, they want to get their money with those movie tie-in covers or TV tie-in covers and everything like that. So that one has definitely seen a reprinting. I don't think any of the rest of these really have, just because of how short the rest of them are, pretty much. You know, The Mist is over 100 pages, but everything else I feel like came in the 20 to 30 page range.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, there is one that comes in at around 50 pages. I believe that was The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, maybe, towards the end there. And
yeah, that sounds right.
That is definitely one we are going to talk a little bit about later, just because of what kind of story that is telling. But with The Mist being the first and the biggest story, I want to talk about that because I have only watched the TV show, which was not good. I won't go into details here on why that is, because I will be doing an episode on it much later down the line, thankfully. And I just didn't get how that adaptation came out of the story after reading this story, because in this, the depiction of the creatures that are going around, you know, you have the tentacles flying in through the roll-up door and trying to just grab onto anything it can grab onto. And you have, you know, this vivid imagery in your head based on the descriptions given in this novella. And it was so much better. That's the only way I could put it. It was just so much better than what my thoughts were when watching the show. I was like, okay, there's The Mist, and I don't know. You know, I don't know how I feel about this. But with this story, I knew exactly how I felt about it. And you have this sort of bad feeling in your gut the entire time you're reading it. You're like, you are really going to go outside? Really? I would not do that. And then they go outside, and then you're just crushed over and over again with this story because of the decisions that the characters make and just what happens to the town in general because of this.
Yeah. Well, there's a kind of like wonderful simplicity with The Mist where you're just putting like a bunch of people in one like cramped place together and turn that into a pressure cooker. And then see what happens. Like, it's this kind of like weird bottle episode of a short novella, or just of a novella that like really examines like kind of like the sociological stress that people would be under that time, and like the religious ramifications that like people would feel.
Yeah, you have a wide variety of characters in this too, which makes it even more interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. And you just get quite a bit of character work from Stephen King in such a short amount of time, given everything that's going on. You know, you really get a sense for how preachy, you know, a certain character is. And the son, who is just terrified, wants his mom, but at the same time, I think deep down he knows that's just not something that's going to happen. You know, Billy seems to be the youngest one in there, from what I can tell.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and there's a huge, like, foreboding element, like, that just runs throughout the entire thing of, like, they are never going to see, like, that woman again, you know? Like, that is something, like, he is never going to see his wife again. The boy is never going to see his mother again. Like, that's just not something that's going to happen. And so there's, like, this huge level of dread that just runs through the entire thing.
Yeah, there's so much dread in this one. It is truly amazing how well Stephen King can just have that dread jump off of the page and just, like, right into you. You're just like, oh, I'm feeling everything that these characters are feeling right now.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing about The Mist is it's one of those Stephen King stories where the thing you have to look out for aren't, like, the scary things that go bump in the night. It's, like, the people. It's doing, like, this thing that, like, The Walking Dead is doing now, except it way before and a lot better, of the people surviving are the ones you have to look out for. And they're the ones that are the most dangerous. And I think there's this kind of, like, Stephen King has this kind of, like, fascination with, like, religion. But he also, I think he understands that it's, like, one of the more dangerous than any villain he's ever created.
Valid point. Very valid point.
We've seen that run through, like, a lot of his novels.
Yeah, definitely.
Like Carrie or The Dead Zone or something. This is such, like, a potentially insidious thing that could affect you. Like, it's great, but it could also be awful.
Yeah. One of the aspects I want to touch on is the government aspect, too. Because you mentioned Carrie, and that's something we see at the end of Carrie, this whole sort of government cover-up as to what happened to that town. And here you get a similar thing, because the government has been working on something in the area and people have had a bad feeling about it. And you get these soldiers who come in and you can tell that they kind of know what's going on, but they don't truly understand what's going on. Because, again, they're just soldiers. They're doing what they're told. And they end up hanging themselves back in, I believe it's just sort of the storage room where they keep the extra supply and everything. And you really get this sense that the government is doing something they should not be. Because why would tentacle things be coming out and attacking people if they weren't doing that?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting to, like, compare that to the Frank Darabont adaptation, because it's very upfront, like, the government did this, it's all their fault, they mess with things they shouldn't have messed with. Like, it's not at all subtle, so I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, reading this basically made me really excited to check out the movie, because I have been told that adaptation in particular is much better than the TV show.
It's much better, but it's also, like, much darker. Like, the ending is a lot darker than how the novel leaves it, or how the novella leaves it off.
Okay. Good to know. I will have to prepare myself before I watch it, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. That's good advice.
So, shall we move on to the next story that we have to talk about, which is The Monkey, which also serves as inspiration for the cover of the copy that I had. It has, you know, the monkey holding the symbols on it.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. The monkey is an interesting story, I think. There's a part of me that, like, throughout reading it, I wasn't sure, like, if the monkey was real. Or, like, not that the monkey wasn't real, but the power that the monkey holds, you know? And I think there's this kind of doubt of that. At least that I felt. you know?
Yeah, because what happens is when the monkey claps the cymbals together, someone dies. And for me, what really resonated with this story was the fact that you have sort of the past coming back to haunt the dad in this, you know, Hal Shelburne. And his kid finds this monkey and brings it back home, essentially. Or they just find it in the house or something. I don't remember the exact details. Like I said, a lot of stories in here. A lot to keep straight here. And
yeah,
for me, it was like, okay, you know, this is this guy's past coming back to haunt him. And he has horrible memories tied to this particular monkey with symbols. And obviously we're talking about a stuffed monkey.
not a real monkey.
Yeah. Not a real magical monkey.
Just a toy magical monkey. It is a kind of like common King theme where it's like trauma that happened to you as a child affecting you while you're an adult, and you going, I know, I buried that. I don't have to deal with that anymore. I don't, please get that away from me. But no, I think the interesting thing I found when I was actually reading it and not listening to the audiobook was how the monkey speaks to him is in italicized font, much like how it would show like some, you know, like inner monologue thoughts. So I think it kind of like wants you to think that like maybe the monkey isn't real, you know, or the power of the monkey isn't real.
Yeah, you can definitely get that sense too. And one of the other things I found interesting was the fact that the younger son could sort of feel the evil coming off of the monkey, though. You know, he got this sense. He was like, I don't like it. And, you know, sometimes kids are weird and they just don't like certain toys over others. But because this was the focus of everyone's attention, you could tell the kid really meant it. He was like, I do not like this. We need to get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, stories like this, I always think of like the Family Guy line, you're just running out of stuff now.
Yeah.
And King is always really good at like taking something that shouldn't at all be scary. Like say a possessed car or a magical monkey, magical toy monkey. And just go, no, this is actually scary. This can actually be terrifying to you, and I'm going to show you how.
Exactly. And this one isn't too terribly long. I feel like when I was reading this one, it flew by pretty quickly for me.
No, it's pretty brisk. I feel like it's paced rather well.
Yeah, and anyone who has read multiple Stephen King books or stories knows that sometimes that's not something he's always consistent with. And there were certain stories here where I kind of felt that way. I was like, okay, I'm reading this. I don't really know what's happening. I don't really know why this is a thing. And you can tell that some of these are definitely early works. And I mentioned to you before we hit record here that I've started reading the Bachman books. And in the introduction, it basically says, you know, I started some of these when I was in high school. So, you know, he kind of sets that expectation for you. And it's not that that necessarily means something is going to be horrible just because it was his early work. You know, he has plenty of early work that is fantastic, in my opinion. And I think it just sort of depends on what kind of story you're looking for. Because then, you know, we have a wide variety of stories in this collection too. It's not quite as theme driven as something like Different Seasons, where you're getting these four novellas in that, which focus a lot on intense character work, and they aren't horror stories. They have horrific things happen in them, but they aren't his typical horror stories that he's telling. And you can definitely tell what some of his influences are as we read through some of these stories, which is why I wanted to talk about The Raft. That seemed very Creature of the Black Lagoon-like, because you have something just sort of under the water and it's very dark out. And, you know, this is one that was actually adapted for Creepshow 2, which I wasn't really aware of anything other than The Mist having been adapted before. So to get that little tidbit, I was like, oh, okay, so, you know, I have that to look forward to because I'll be getting to Creepshow 2, I want to say relatively soon. I suppose it depends on how long it takes me to read Bachman books and it, which will probably be a while. So, yeah. You know, this one just felt like his sort of monster story aside from The Mist. It was a different kind of monster story. You know, you're going out in the middle of the night and you're swimming out to, you know, this sort of buoy raft kind of thing. And they're teenagers screwing around. It's like, yes, you have perfectly set us up for some monster to come out in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I found interesting about this story was that I can kind of feel the Stephen King cipher in this, where, like, I think Stephen King identifies himself as, like, the main character. And, like, all the other characters are, to varying degrees, sort of awful. Except for him, who is, like, the nerdy, like, book geek, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone else is just allowed to be awful. Just, like, joggish or, the female characters in this aren't really well served in typical, like, horror monster movie fashion.
Yeah.
That's not great. That's not, I don't think that's something that's aged particularly well.
It's the 80s. Sometimes, you know, some of these might have been done in the 70s. I'm not 100% sure on the exact dates for when a lot of these stories were written, but it's one of those things where, you know, something might not play off as well today, but you still can't just write it off necessarily because it's know, this is one of those things where it's kind of tough to talk about like older works in 2019 because you're like, you know, so much has changed since the 80s. I feel like so much has changed just even from like the early 2000s.
Well, yeah.
It's like, okay, we got to keep up with all the ways that things are changing. And literature and entertainment in general, I guess, even songs, movies, TV, they kind of serve as this time capsule. And you can just go back and be like, oh, so that's what things were like during this time, especially a time period that I was not yet born. You know, I am an early 90s kid. I don't know what things were like in the 80s. So to sort of get that perspective while I've been reading through a lot of these 80s Stephen King works, it's like, okay, you know, you kind of get a sense for who Stephen King was in the 80s. And you can obviously tell he's a progressive guy. You know, he's not stuck in the 80s. There are plenty of people who probably are. And, you know, that's their thing. I sort of just like being able to see how things have changed because I have read some more recent Stephen King stuff. I'm not going into this totally blind. You know, I had read a handful of things before diving into this and they were kind of scattered all over the place. I had read The Shining. I had read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, Cell, you know, so very different time periods for some of those things. So I at least had a sense of what I was getting myself into, basically. And, you know, that was kind of nice to have that going into this. I wasn't just totally starting from the beginning and being like, yeah, let's jump in with, you know, Carrie.
No, King has allowed himself to evolve over the time, over the decades, and that's good.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's move on to Nona, which is a very Bonnie and Clyde type story based on the perspective that it's told from. And I found that to be pretty interesting. I don't know if it's because I happen to have just recently watched The Highwaymen on Netflix. So, you know, Bonnie and Clyde were already kind of recently on the mind here, but it was sort of just a fun story, even though this guy was so tortured throughout it, you know, you could tell you're just going alongside this tortured character and he has this obsession with this girl he hardly knows. And I don't know what about it really made it stand out to me, but I was like, you know what, this one kind of stuck in my head here and I don't really know why. And I think sometimes that's another great thing about reading things. Sometimes you just get pure enjoyment out of something and you don't necessarily need to know why. Just that enjoyment is enough. And like I said, this isn't like a happy ending story. I'm not really sure what Stephen King's story is. So, you know, there is that, but it was sort of just, you know, brutal, quick, and to the point.
It's kind of this like weird look at sociopathy where like there are a lot of like lines throughout it going, he got in my way. if he hadn't been in my way, this wouldn't have happened. And just like this kind of like mild psychosis going throughout it where like, I'm not entirely sure that Nona existed by the time I got to the end of it, you know? Or the girl that's in this story, I should say. Where it's, but, and it kind of has you like wondering, like, getting into a mindset of like Stephen King stories where like Occam's Razor says the girl didn't exist.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking the whole time. You know?
The guy's just nuts. But it seems totally within keeping of a Stephen King story that this guy just keeps saying rat people his entire life.
And then there is the possibility that she is real and she's just as twisted as he is.
Yeah, and she just died. So it's a weird story.
Yeah, so many possibilities. It's weird, but I don't know why. I just really liked it, and that's why I put it on the list of what's to talk about.
Yeah, and also, just funny seeing a mention of Castle Rock.
Yeah. Shall we go ahead and move on to Grandma? Because this one definitely has some Stephen King universe tie-ins.
Yeah. And this was a strange one.
It really was. And I felt so bad for that kid. So bad for that kid. And it reminded me of Pet Sematary a little bit because, you know, Rachel is the only one who is home when Zelda dies. So there was that parallel there. And I was like, oh, you know, this kind of reminds me of that. And it helps that the adaptation just came out recently. So that's another thing that was sort of fresh on my mind there. But then, you know, it's Henrietta Dodd, who is the mother of Frank Dodd from all the rapes and the killings in the Dead Zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's weird how, like, that is just so easily brushed over in the story and in the way that, like, family members would.
Yes.
You know?
Especially because the boy who we are following throughout the story seems so young. I believe he's only, you know, like 8 or 9 or something like that.
So something I thought, this kind of reminded me, especially after seeing it, reminded me of Hereditary.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that, but
I have. Great movie.
Yes. How this ends and like the kind of witchiness of it and the possession.
Yeah.
It felt like a very serious precursor to that.
Yeah, this one just seemed so wild to me. I was like, wow, you are putting this kid through the ringer here. And it's one of those things where I don't know. I was just so absorbed into how it tied in to everything, you know, because Henrietta Dodd and Frank Dodd both appear in the Dead Zone movie. And in the book, it's a little more subtle. I don't think it's quite as obvious as it is in the movie, but that was something that worked well in the movie that might not have worked quite as well in the book. And I don't know if Frank Dodd was ever actually named in the book. It's sort of just one of those things where now everyone kind of knows that's who they were talking about.
Yeah.
Because of the mentions we've had throughout the years, because Frank Dodd has been mentioned in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially recently with like Castle Rock.
Yeah.
Where he gets more than one mention in that, I believe.
I think so. It's nice that this focused on Henrietta Dodd, though, through the lens of her grandson, because he doesn't really seem to know what had happened. He just goes off mentioning his mother's siblings, and that's that. You know, it's not a huge focus to make this all about Frank Dodd. And it was one of those things where you could tell, you know, there was just something so sad about it too.
Yeah, and it's, well, it's sad, and it's also like quietly sinister, and just in the way that like everyone has like that that like elderly relative where like I really don't know what to do with that person.
Yeah.
Or I am very uneasy being around that person. And that's definitely like the mode that he's in throughout this entire story. And just the way that like he convinces himself like you would that like, no, it's fine. It's, she's just an old person. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And you have all of this craziness going on. You know, he can't really get in touch with anyone. And when he does, he's like, oh, okay, that's a very strange interaction with my aunt there. And, you know, because she's just like yelling at him, do this, do that. And, you know, this kid is just in such a panic because, you know, he is like trying to figure out what to do with his grandma and she dies. And then he's just sort of stuck waiting for someone to show up.
Yeah. And then like the terror that she's not actually dead.
Yeah. He just thinks she is.
Yeah. And possessed him by the end of the story?
Yeah, it was so
which
wild.
Which is very uncomfortable.
I was like, wow, so many things are going on in this.
That is a dark ending. Like, yeah. Even by Stephen King standards, that's a dark ending where, like, the kid is dead, I guess?
Yeah.
His spirit is dead?
So weird. It was yeah. Almost like, you know, Henrietta couldn't save her own son, so she takes her grandson. I don't even really know what the thinking is behind this one. It just amazed me. I was like, wow, that is a lot to take in, Stephen King. So much. But because of the fact that it just ties in more than I would say most of the other stories do to stuff we have already known about for a while now, it felt like a good one to talk about. The last one I really want to discuss, though, is The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, because this one is very different from a lot of the other stories in this, and it felt so meta as far as the world of book publishing goes and story publishing. Yeah. So, you know, Stephen King is not afraid to get meta. He will clearly drop mentions of people reading his own books in other books of his. That's something that has happened on numerous occasions, if I'm not mistaken. So this was sort of his way of giving, I guess, an op-ed on what it's like to try and have a story published. But there's this twist to it, and there's this dark twist to it, which is obviously his specialty.
Yeah. Well, like it kind of reminded me of a conversation that you and me had on this podcast. I don't know if it was Cycle of the Werewolf, maybe. Where we're talking about how the publishing industry, like, that Stephen King did for, like, a lot of his stories just simply does not exist anymore, you know? Like, the kind of literary magazine of, like, I'm going to put this this little story in a magazine and somebody will pay me X and X dollars for it. Like, that just does not exist anymore.
It's very few and far between these days. There are still some out there, but I think a lot of them have gone the way of digital. So they put together like these digital collections quarterly or something like that. I haven't really looked too much into actual literary magazines. You know, every once in a while you'll get like a normal magazine that will publish short stories, you know, like GQ or something, I think is one where either Stephen King himself or someone else has had short stories published. I don't know. But he would get his stories in some pretty odd magazines back in the day, too. You're like, oh, okay, Penthouse? Really? Are we sure they publish short stories?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I appreciated the line in the story of, if you gathered all of the editors in New York, you could kill them all with a single shotgun blast.
Yeah.
Which is both sad but very accurate, I think.
Yes. It is cruel but not untrue.
Yeah, but I like this kind of look at the quote unquote like tortured artist, and the kind of commentary is trying to make on like the amount of artists that like end up committing suicide by the end.
Yeah.
After they've established like some level of success. What was the Jason Segel biopic?
I have no idea. I'm sorry.
it's gonna come to me when, at like 3 o'clock in the morning. That's okay. It's only gonna bug me for the rest of my life. but just these talented people that like are so consumed with like their own neuroses and their own like the thing that makes them so great, the thing that makes them like makes people want to read them is the thing that like also puts them in danger.
Was it the end of the tour that you were thinking of?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, the David Foster Wallace.
David Foster Wallace. Thank you. Now I'll hate myself just a little bit less. But no, it's an interesting look at like how at risk like that kind of person is.
Yeah.
And just like the kind of like slow descent into madness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He does it so well in this too.
Yeah. Well, and also like showing somebody with like some level of schizophrenia without ever actually saying the word. And I don't know if they had that kind of language when he wrote it. I doubt it. But just such an interesting look at that and how you kind of get sucked into that. Or at least how the main character gets sucked into that kind of thinking and kind of like paranoia towards like modern advancements, I guess, is the best way to put that. Like technology and things that would like come to make the industry they work in less viable.
One of the things that it really reminded me of was Better Call Saul.
Yes, that was, yeah, I also had that thought.
Yeah, and, you know, so Michael McKean in Better Call Saul plays Chuck, and he eventually, I don't know if he is actually diagnosed with this, or he just decides that he's, like, allergic to electricity, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But he goes into this state where he turns off all of the power to his house. He's using lanterns and, you know, more natural sources of light. He won't let anyone bring any electronic devices in the house because they apparently hurt him. And this character in this story just reminded me so much of those scenes in Better Call Saul. And I was like, wow, you know, Stephen King wrote about this way before Better Call Saul did, and I had no idea. And obviously it's a different situation. You know, Chuck is working at this big successful law firm. He's not a writer who is sort of isolated anyway to begin with. I think a lot of writers, and I don't want to say all of them are this way, but it seems like writers sort of like to do their work by themselves. You know, Stephen King lives in Maine. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say Maine is super populated.
Oh, yeah. Well, like anyone who's had like a quota of articles to do in one day knows like what that feels like of like, I need to do this and please don't bother me. I'm going to shut myself away for like an entire day.
Yeah, if I don't just like sit at my computer and write, it takes me so much longer. So much longer. It's like, okay, you know, and if I'm listening to a podcast that I find interesting, it'll take longer. So, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes you just have to put music on and write or not put anything on and write just to be able to get it done. And this was just such a great commentary on the writing and publishing world, especially at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. And there's also just a universality to it that, like, I think still applies. Because, like, the kind of, like, the danger that exists in that thinking and existing like that is all too real.
Yeah. I do want to give a quick honorable mention to Word Processor of the Gods, where you can just type things in and either hit insert or delete and they will magically appear in your life or be deleted from your life.
Which is the most horrifying thing I can possibly think of. As
especially in 2019. Yeah. You know, ooh, I do not want my keyboard having that much power. Thank you.
Yeah. My keyboard already has too much power in my life to begin with, and I'd rather not give it anymore.
Yeah, so I thought that one deserved a little honorable mention while we were on the topic of writing. But one of the last things I want to discuss for the book as a whole here is the theme of it, which is to say that there is not one.
Yeah, not really. There's a kind of, not a running theme, but there is this kind of quote or like line that goes through like a couple of these stories, and it's kind of dedicated at the beginning of this collection, which is, do you love?
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have like the monkey asking, do you love, or the rat and Nona.
Yeah.
And just this kind of taunting psychological torture of like, do you love? Is there like any kind of meaning here?
Right.
And I kind of wonder if that's not a little bit of the point of like this collection of stories, where it's like, they're so random and jumbled, and they're so clearly from like different points in Stephen King's writing career up to that point.
Yeah.
Where there's this kind of like wondering of like, does this matter? And like, does any, like, is there a real purpose to this? And I think that, like, that reflects nicely back to, like, Ballad of the Bullet, as we talked about, like, just Stephen King wondering, like, how much of this is actually essential?
Right.
How much of this matters?
What is relevant and what is not? Yeah, I totally get what you mean. For me, one of the stories that really stuck out was The Jaunt, because it was very futuristic, which is unlike most Stephen King stories. You know, yes, we have had the concept of time travel pop up, especially in 11/22/63, but I feel like that was entirely different. This just felt like something where maybe he was trying his hand at some different kind of science fiction aspect to his stories, and it just didn't land with me. I don't know if it's just because it felt so out of place, and maybe somewhere else it would have fit better, but to me, those aren't really the kinds of stories that he writes. You do have some fantasy elements in quite a few of his stories. You know, the Dark Tower series is driven with fantasy, and I don't know. Something about The Jaunt just stuck out like a sore thumb to me. And I was like, oh, what's going on? What am I reading? And then you get back into it with The Wedding Gig, which is like a mob story, but like not as good as anything on The Sopranos. You're just like, okay, you know, things get a little bumpy here and there. And, you know, I think ultimately because of the stories that I did like, I was willing to overlook some of those things. But for me, you know, you get these motifs, I guess you could say, throughout, but you never really get a overarching theme, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, like, one that I remember thinking, like, this is a weird story to include, is the one that directly follows The Mist, which is Here There Be Tigers, which is just, what if there's a tiger in the school bathroom? And you're just like, why are we doing this? Why is this a story you felt compelled to tell? It's very strange.
Yeah, it was just one of those things where I was like, okay, all right, this was a thing I read, and not all of it was good, but some of it was really, really good. So ultimately, I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. Technically, I gave it a 3 out of 5 on Goodreads, because you can't do half stars, and it still drives me crazy. But I basically, in the review section, I'll just put like 3.5 in the star emoji so that I know when I have wanted to rate something a half star. So if they ever change that, I can then go back and, you know, fix all of those that I want to put half stars in. But, you know, it was fine overall for me. And I really liked The Mist. I think that was a good choice, putting that right up front for you.
Yeah,
it's like, here is what we are going to dive in with. And then having the Ballad of the Flexible Bullet towards the end there, I was like, okay, I can sort of get into quite a few of these stories, and that made it worth my time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. It's a solid collection of jumbled stories. And I think it's a better look at, like, these kind of stories than, like, some of the other ones he's done, like Four Past Midnight, which is a garbage garbage fire of a collection, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. But I don't know how I'm going to feel about all of the short story collections necessarily, because if I'm not mistaken, there are quite a few more to come for me. You know,
Yeah.
You and I covered Night Shift, and then I covered different seasons, and now this one. And as far as I know, there's at least, you know, 5 to 7 more. And it'll be interesting to see as I go which ones sort of have this overarching theme and which ones are sort of more a hodgepodge of stories like this one.
From what I can recall, they're mostly hodgepodges. Like, okay. Nightmares and Dreamscapes doesn't really have a thing. Like, there's a story in that one of a guy getting attacked by miniature toy soldiers. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a thing. We'll leave it at that.
It's a thing. Yeah, it's a thing. And I think the thing that Stephen King does is that he just has, like, all these miscellaneous ideas in his head. And he goes, well, I can't stretch that out into a full-length novel. I would if I could.
He definitely
But I
would.
Can't.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how those go then. But, Drew, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this one. You seem to be, you know, signing up for a few of the short story collections here, so, you know, we'll see what happens.
It's apparently my groove. TV shows and short stories.
Yeah, well, again, thank you. And to our listeners, you can find us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram. It would be awesome if you could subscribe to the podcast. We have a link that will show you all of the places you can subscribe to it, which is a lot more than I thought. So, you know, there are lots of options out there. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.